call the Business, Industry, and Jobs Committee to order. Today is March 12th. We've got 10 bills, only 9. Did we pull time or something?
It's already been pulled.
And if there's a way we can get through these this afternoon, we will not come back tonight. We do have a room available for us, but I think we'd like to be thorough here, but at the same time move along and get our work done. So with that, we're going to start as a subcommittee, but that's all right. And we'll hear the first bill, Senate File 35158, Senator Scogin, Explore Minnesota Tourism Vacation Rental Lodging Study. Welcome to the committee, and you may proceed as you'd like.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee, for hearing this bill, second stop on its way. Out in my district, over 1,200 lakes, we have a real interesting mix. We have resorters, and then we have non-resident, non-homestead people who live out there. And at times, they like to rent out their home. And it helps them pay property taxes. It helps them upkeep their lake cabins. But the resorters and those homeowners have come to the conclusion that although the resorters don't mind that they do that, they just want to make sure if they're charging a seasonal rate, if they're collecting rent on this property, that they're held to some of the same standards so that the playing field is level, because in the end they kind of compete with them. They'd like to make sure that they're up to fire code, that the sewers are working properly, the water's been tested, and all the other things that occur when somebody stays at a resort. We give those clients some protection, and I think the resorters would just like to know that these homeowners also are offering those same protections to people that that rent their places. And it goes beyond letting your family stay there for the weekend or just letting some friends stay there. This is actually when you are advertising and renting these out for long periods of time. They want to make sure that the playing field is somewhat level. So we needed a study to see how prevalent this is and what the conclusion might be. And Minnesota Tourism has offered to do that. It comes without a fiscal note because they feel that they can do it internally and get us the information we need to proceed to the next step on leveling that playing field. Joel Carlson, who represents the resorters, is with us here today. And if you have questions about this particular bill committee, he would be more than willing to answer those. He may want to provide some additional testimony as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Carlson, Joel, did you have anything to add?
No, Mr. Chairman.
Pretty well.
The Congress of Minnesota Resorts, who I've had the pleasure of representing since 1996, appreciates the work of the legislature to help the small resorting industry. We used to have about 3,000 resorts in Minnesota. We're down to about 900. This is an emerging issue for us, and we would appreciate your support for this study so that we're all on a level playing field, and we don't want to kill this practice. We want to promote it. But we just want to make certain that that it's safe for the consumer, good for the tourism industry, and that everyone is appropriately protected. Be happy to answer any questions, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, well, that's the this is a study and looking into it. Just a comment: if somebody rents to their neighbor or something for a couple hundred bucks a week, and then you go in and say you have to sprinkle it or something, or that's what comes to my mind right away. That we can't be arbitrary either,
And Mr. Chairman and members, I want to be real clear. This isn't people that are renting out their cabin for a week during the summer while they're gone. We have people who are in the business of renting homes
just renting
on a nightly, weekly, or monthly basis that are currently outside of regulation. They're outside of the local lodging tax. They advertise on the Internet. We're not talking about people that are just renting out their place for a week or two here and there. We don't have a clear definition of what rental lodging is in Minnesota, and that's one of the things this study is attempting to define is what is it, and if it is rental lodging, what regulation should they be subject to?
Well, I'm glad I asked the question to get it on the tape that you're not out for the...
No, that's not... That's,
goes to,
we have no concern with that
week or something
whatsoever. We're talking about people that are in the business of providing vacation rental lodging.
Okay, any further discussion? I'll announce there is a quorum present.
Do you want to fix it?
Is there something that has to be fixed, did you say? Okay, Senator Michelle.
I'll move the bill. Move the bill, Mr. Chair.
Senate File 3158 be recommended to pass, and apparently it doesn't have to go anywhere.
Yes, Mr. Chair, we'd like to, Senator Tomassoni would like to see it over in economic development.
Well, he's not even here.
No money in it, is there?
Mr. Chairman and members, although there's no money attendant to this, I believe that the Finance Committee asked for it so that they know what the agency is doing with the money that's appropriated to them. We don't think that's a problem. It went there in the House, and we're happy to do it in the Senate at Senator Tomassoni's request.
Okay, we like to make life a little easier for people, but if you want to make more stops or
Mr.
don't
Chair,
want to, but if they're asking
you are
for,
the chair.
I don't see the need, but we're and we don't care what the House did either. But what do you want to do?
House strained, Mr. Chair.
Go to the floor.
What, Senator Tomassoni, did you ask for this bill or something?
We don't have a request.
We don't have a request.
It's actually about.
Let's go to the floor.
I think we'll go to the floor. That's the motion.
Okay.
Objection? Yes.
Send it to the floor, then if I find out I need it, we can get
okay.
it.
There you go. Thank you. Works for us.
Oh, what a nice boy today. All right. On that motion by Senator Michelle, that Senate File 3158 be recommended pass and sent to the floor. All those in favor?
Aye.
Five are saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion prevails.
Andy, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Lucius.
Who is there? Senator Moi, Senate File 3035, Criminal Records, Private Employers, Use Restrictions Bill. Senator Moi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Chair, when this bill was in front of the Judiciary Committee, there were some discussions about a portion of the bill. And at that time, we wanted to do something, but we couldn't quite put our fingers on what it was that needed to be tweaked with, and we moved it out of the Judiciary Committee to your committee with the some thought that we would continue to work on finishing the final massages to create perhaps the best language possible, and that is specifically to the immunity section of the bill, and I believe Senator Scheid has an amendment. So I wonder if the committee would take a look at that amendment, and then as we explain the bill, I'd like to explain incorporating the amendment. And what it does...
You want to address the amendment first or whatever?
Mr. Chair, it's up to you, but I would like to... We can either do the amendment first and put it on the bill, and then I could go through the rest of the bill. There are two distinct provisions in the bill, so the amendment pertains to one of the provisions of the bill.
Okay, let's Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, I move the A4 amendment.
Okay, why don't you
and it pertains,
explain the amendment to us.
And it pertains to page 3. It would delete the language that's in sub 3 there, immunity from civil liability, and insert what would be an affirmative defense. So instead of just a blanket immunity from liability, and this has to do with a company hiring someone who has a criminal record. So and the bill has to do with that, and so it may have been more helpful to note that the bill has to do this, but it has to do with this particular amendment deals with the liability and immunity from that, or at least being able to provide an affirmative defense. If you hire someone and you are later sued for negligent hiring because that person had a criminal record, if you can show that when you hired that person, the conviction did not relate to the kind of employment, the position they were getting at your company, and that they showed or that they had shown evidence of sufficient rehabilitation. In other words, you felt comfortable in hiring them because they were rehabilitated, you believed that, and were fit to do the job for which you hired them. I think that's what it says, and I think it is, I think that would make me more comfortable with that section.
Me
giving
or
employers
me.
Some protection.
Me or me?
I've said we've got to do a who's on first with
yeah.
this.
Excuse me.
And Mr. Chair, members,
did you look at this? Or you?
Yes, and I apologize. This is something that we should have taken care of in the Judiciary Committee, as it was within that committee's jurisdiction.
All right.
But as we were discussing the bill, and in the interest of the time, the members registered the concern that we couldn't come up with what it was. And I think that the affirmative defense language accomplishes the same spirit and intent of the language that passed out of the committee. But the thing is, I think the affirmative defense is a cleaner, better way to address the protection for the employers in this instance, instead of sort of the blanket immunity up front. And so it the amendment doesn't violate the spirit of what we're trying to do in getting that section out of the Judiciary Committee, but I think it's just a better mechanism and tool to achieve that.
Okay. Any comments on the amendment from the members? Seeing none, Senator Scheid moves the A4 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion prevails. Now, Senator Moore.
So, Mr. Chair, members, on the bill, you all have a summary in front of you, and I think that is a very good explanation. So let me just very quickly walk through that summary with you to make it clear. As I mentioned earlier, the bill contains two provisions intended to promote economic opportunities. And the way that we see that helping is to give people an opportunity to, despite their criminal records, we're not making them go away, but give an opportunity for individuals to be able to obtain jobs. The first part of the bill, so there are some other provisions of the bill that I should highlight for you. In Section 1 of the bill, Section 1 deletes the sunset provision on Internet access to BCA records. And Section 1 basically preserves the right of a job applicant to be notified when an employer uses the website to conduct a background check. Section 2 of the bill merely is a housekeeping matter, and it just replaces the references to of the language of this chapter to more specific statutory citations. Section 3 of the bill is really where the heart of the substance of the bill is. And Section 3 basically has two provisions. One provision prohibits private employers from using non-conviction records in hiring. It provides some uniformity between public and private employers. Public employers have been prohibited from using non-conviction records in hiring or licensing since 1974. And so we just want to extend that to private employers. This will allow individuals who are seeking jobs an easier and give them a more fair opportunity to be able to get a job. The use of the arrest record is still allowed or required in many areas of private employment, but it does not in any way seal or expunge non-conviction records. Section 2 of the law is what we of the amendment that we've just put on, and it basically is an opportunity here to say that if you are an employer that we in trying to move forward this public policy agenda to allow people to be able to get jobs, we are also providing want to balance it from an employer's perspective. And so the affirmative defense that was in the amendment that was added is our attempt to address the needs of the employers. Mr. Chair and members, I have with me today a couple of individuals. I know that the chamber wants to testify in opposition to the bill, but there are a couple of individuals here who would like to testify on the bill very briefly. I would like to ask Mr. Tom Johnson and Mr. Tom Boardman to both come up here to present their testimonies.
Sure. Good afternoon. Welcome to the committee, gentlemen.
Yes.
Johnson first or welcome.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Tom Johnson with the Gray Plant Moody Law Firm. I was formerly with the Council on Crime and Justice, and the Council is supportive of this legislation. We see it being advantageous for three reasons, or at three different levels. First, with respect to job applicants, we believe that it will open up job opportunities for those who may now face a barrier to employment because they have a record. Secondly, at the employer level, we believe that it will expand the pool of job applicants that they can consider for employment without risk, or at least reduced risk, of facing liability exposure. And then thirdly, at the general public level, We believe that by providing greater job opportunities, you enhance public safety by reducing the rate of recidivism amongst those who have a criminal record. And at the Judiciary Committee, County Attorney Mike Freeman testified very strongly to the connection between employment and criminal activities, and his belief that this bill would, in fact, reduce the level of recidivism by creating job opportunities. The senator has already gone through the two provisions. I've been involved in the drafting of those provisions, so I'd gladly take questions if there are other questions on it, but I'll cut my testimony short at that point.
I see on the back of the Council of Crime and Justice there are some exemptions, if you will, where you can't work at certain spots. If that correct? That's what I get out of it.
Correct.
The serving children or something, and is that, Mr. Johnson?
Mr. Chair, the subdivision 2 that relates to the prohibition on the use of arrest records, that is to make private employers comparable to public employers in this state, there is a long list of exceptions to that, and it relates, and it's those that are listed there, those are background checks that are either required or permitted by law, and those could continue to be, arrest records in those instances could continue to be used.
Okay, that's what I, yeah.
And it particularly relates to positions in which a person is, job applicant or position is working with a vulnerable person.
Yeah, I thought that was the case, but I thought I better ask and make sure that they're, things are. Okay, sir, did you wish to say something?
Yes, please. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Tom Boardman, and I'm here really today wearing two hats. One of my hats is as Vice President and Deputy General Counsel of 3M Company, and my other hat is as a board member of the Council on Crime and Justice, where I am the Vice Chair of the Board of Directors. First of all, let me tell you just a bit about what the policy is at 3M. 3M does background checks on prospective employees. It checks only for convictions. It does not check for arrest records. For convictions, it goes back 7 years, and it does that on a uniform basis across the country. Now, there are some practical considerations as to why the company does that. We are an employer. We employ people across the United States, and there are a number of states that already have prohibitions against accessing arrest records, non-conviction records, including our neighbor to the east, Wisconsin. So that's a practical consideration, although I have to tell you that if we wanted to do this on a state-by-state basis, we certainly could do so. Our policy, however, is that we do not access non-conviction arrest records when doing background checks on prospective employees. Secondly, in my role on the Board of Directors in the Council on Crime and Justice, and also in my practice in representing pro bono clients, I've seen the data, and it's really quite compelling in terms of young people in the state of Minnesota, particularly young men of color. The arrest records are really quite staggering, and as I mentioned in my pro bono practice, I have represented clients where they have gotten caught into this cycle of being arrested, not being charged, not being convicted of anything, and then not being able to find a job. And that feeds on itself. And once these young people get in this cycle, it is extremely difficult to get them out of that cycle. So I've seen that firsthand in representing clients on a pro bono basis, and I've seen the data in my role on the board at the Council on Crime and Justice. As a result, in that role on the council, I am strongly supportive of the bill.
Any questions of the author or the witnesses? I believe, if not, if the chamber is listed as opposing this, do they wish to? Okay, are you, Mr. Hickey, did you want to grab a chair also? And
if possible, Mr. Chair.
All right, you guys, you can figure out who wants to talk first, and welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Dave Dietrichs with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, and thank you for the opportunity to come speak to you today about the Senate file. As a practical matter, just like to state up front that the Chamber does oppose this bill, and for several reasons, but most importantly, and this echoes the sentiments that were just made by Mr. Boardman when he was up here speaking on behalf of 3M and the Council on Crime and Justice, and the fact of the matter is most employers don't use non-conviction arrest records when they do employment searches for their new hiring decisions. And the reason is simple. It also echoes the sentiments that he just laid out before you, and that is because there's a disproportionate number of minorities that are arrested, particularly in the Twin Cities, and that means that if an employer did use non-employment arrest records or non-conviction arrest records in making hiring decisions, they could possibly be subject to being sued under the Minnesota Human Rights Act for discrimination in hiring decisions. And so as a practical matter, we see no need for the implementation of this law. Now to some particulars of the bill, in regard to Subdivision 2, we're concerned that this would basically preserve the jobs of people who have been arrested at the employer's expense. So if someone is arrested and they're not able to come to work, this bill would essentially prohibit employers from even inquiring as to why their employees are not coming to work. And if they did, then they could be subject to the penalties that are addressed later in this bill. It could also, and this is an extreme measure that one of our employment law attorneys got back to us with, but it is also feasible under this bill. It could also place a workplace at risk. For example, if an employee was jailed for something as extreme as terroristic threats involving his or her workplace, the employer under Subdivision 2 would face sanctions for even inquiring about the circumstances and taking action regarding the employer. So again, this would be wouldn't be allowing the employers to inquire about the circumstances of their employees and where they are. Subdivision 3, I realize that was just amended, but okay, private employers do not find it desirable to jump through all the hoops governing that govern public employers when they make hiring decisions. In fact, there's an argument that we can be made. Our employment law attorneys tell us that if an employer does jump through all these same hoops that public employers are subject to for hiring decisions, that an aggrieved applicant who didn't get hired would have a good argument for against an employer for not being hired. And finally, Subdivision 4 regarding the damages, we see the $1,000 penalty as not helpful because basically it's a floor and not a ceiling. Depending on a court, actual damages, specifically under the Minnesota Human Rights Act already allow for treble damages, unlimited emotional distress, attorney's fees, and unlimited civil damages. And so a $1,000 floor doesn't do much. And attorney's fees also included in this bill can make weak claims a lot stronger. And finally, I just want to make one last point. It's on line 3.22 and line 3.23. And it says that if an employer were to use a non-conviction record for private employment, and then it goes on to say how they got a hold of this. It says, or obtain access to a non-conviction criminal record from another source. Arguably, you could state that if an employer has a newspaper delivered to his desk that contains a story about an arrest or even posts notices about arrest records in a community, that could constitute notice under this bill, and therefore an employer could be sanctioned for that. And with that, I'll conclude my comments. Thank you.
Okay. Any other witnesses like to say anything?
Mr. Chairman, Mike Hickey with the National Federation of Independent Business. And actually, there's just one point I wanted to make, echoing Dave's comments. The original bill, we were a lot less concerned about, and it said, quote, citation or criminal complaint against an individual not then pending. And that's what's really key here, and possibly the intention is not to try to provide this type of protection for somebody currently under arrest with a trial pending. I can't believe that's the intent, but that's how we're all reading the words. And that's the big concern. You have a current employee arrested, detained, unable to go to work. You can't inquire why they can't go to work. You may not ever want this person back. I guess you have to depends on what the outcome of the criminal case is. But to put these kind of prohibitions on an employer, you can't find out why they can't come to work. You can't inquire into it. It is really a concerning situation. The original bill didn't do that. Against an individual not then pending. So this is a big change. This bill is really concerning, and this bill really needs to be fixed up or amended, and I hope you don't advance it out of here. Thanks.
Sir, did you wish to comment?
Mr. Chair, members, Kevin Matzik representing Hospitality Minnesota. I would echo, in the interest of time, I would echo the comments of the previous two testifiers.
Senator Koch, did you have a question?
Well, Mr. Chair, and to the witnesses, so this very much hits home for me. It just happened to a certain company, for which we'll call it Company X. Last week, person was missing for a few days. Eventually, he came in and told us he'd been in jail and had to wait for the bail. So you're saying that with this bill, we would have no right to know why he'd been in jail.
You couldn't, Mr. Chair and Senator, you could not make an inquiry, nor could you if you had information regarding what happened to them. Let's say they were in jail for an extended period of time. You couldn't make a firing decision or a termination decision based on that.
Really?
Right.
Is that Mr. Fuller's understanding of this as well?
I think he was not paying attention. Did you hear that?
All right, well, then I'll trust these guys.
He was paying attention.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Cook, I didn't have the totally same impression. I think that's an interpretation law, but I'm just reading it for the first time. I guess I would ask where on lines, I mean, if somebody isn't at work and you fire them and it turns out that they're in jail, but we're in jail. I don't see where that's a prohibited action under here. Maybe it is, but I just don't. It doesn't jump out at me.
I don't see it either. Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, the language from 312 to 314, a non-conviction criminal record, that's kind of, it sounds oxymoronic or something, you know. It's not a term we usually that I'm used to using, but that's what you can't get information about. And what it means is that you can't, if there's nothing pending and there's no conviction, you can't get information about it. But I'm assuming if somebody's arrested, there is some criminal proceeding that's pending. Wouldn't there be if you're arrested? I mean, there's some.
Well, Mr. Chair, but if you're only in jail for a couple days, there's no conviction. You're pending.
Well, Mr. Chair,
you are pending, or are you pending until you? I don't know.
Mr. Chair,
why did you have a reaction?
In the definition section, there is a definition for non-conviction criminal records, and it means a record of an arrest, citation, complaint, prosecution, or other record relating to a criminal proceeding that is not pending and did not result in a conviction. So I think that counsel's interpretation is correct, and the companies could, if you look at the definition of non-conviction criminal record, the interpretation would be clear that in this case it wouldn't apply.
Yeah, that's what I think. Mr. Chairman, that's what I think.
Can the kid tell you? Okay, any... further discussion on the bill, Senator. Do you have a wrap up or anything?
Mr. Chairman, I apologize. There's one gentleman who is here. He would like to comment on the bill, and I wasn't aware of it until I finished my testimony. He actually works with individuals who are affected by this, and
sure.
I know you have a lot on your agenda, but I really appreciate it.
We have nine bills today, and we'd like to get through them, but we're not going to stifle any. Discussion on anything today.
We're down
to
eight after this, Mr. Chair.
Wait. You might cut people short, but we won't. Good morning, or good afternoon. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, I can't be cut any shorter. Levity always helps.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Senators. I'd like to submit my testimony, actually, for the record in addition.
Yes, I just have a question, Mr. Chair. Material.
Sir. Just
a question perhaps you could address. I have a bill in the Education Committee that also came to Senator Mouat's committee regarding the hiring of teachers and some concerns that were raised recently about backgrounds of teachers that were not caught during the criminal background check. And that particular bill will require school districts to ask the Board of Teaching to look into their file if there's been any disciplinary action regarding some sort of sexual misconduct that was not prosecuted, that was not a criminal incident. But certainly, to me, sort of looks like this, that it's not they have not been convicted, but we think that our school district should be aware of disciplinary action or other kinds of behavior that they may want to be aware of. So I guess that's why I'm wondering, is that consistent with this? Because to me, then, like we're saying to businesses, you shouldn't be able to even look at that. We're not telling them they can't hire, but to me, we should be having similar sorts of a threshold.
Is that covered under the exceptions part of it?
Correct. Mr. Chair, and Senator Saltzman, schools are a public employer that are already exempted. And also, anybody else, private or otherwise, who is currently required to do a criminal background check by law, they're not covered under this language.
And Senator, I know Saltzman, that's Senator Moi, but just to be consistent, why would we have different thresholds for business versus our these other areas? Is there a reason why business should not be able to have access to that same kind of information?
Senator Saltzman, the bill merely is extending to the private sector what under current law has been extended to public employers. So it actually is bringing the private employers into consistency with what public employers are currently doing.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Sir, did you wish to?
Thank you, sir. Mr. Chair, Senators, my name is Boyce Jones. I'm a project manager for Emerge Community Development in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Our focus is on workforce, staffing, villages, and ventures. Since August of 2004, I created a project called the Northside Jobs Connection. The Northside Job Connection worked with people with limited work histories, gang-involved, formerly gang-involved, or documented criminal history. Our responsibility is to assist people who have multiple barriers to employment. And I'm here to speak on this bill because one of the things that I have found characteristically out of the population of the people that come through our doors is that they tend to have that documented criminal background in common. Subsequently, we have, I think, for the record, have a reentry program, but for the reality is we didn't start out as a reentry program. It's just, again, those characteristics were very common. So in order to get relief for the population we work with, subsequently we had to begin to work on what may be notably known as reentry programs. Since 2004, I actually started the program with a $35,000 grant from the city of Minneapolis in order to work with this population. It's been 4 years, and we've served over 450 people who are ex-offenders, placing them into full-time employment. But again, I like to add that I had 750 people come through the door. What I'm really saying is that although we made a great deal of strides, what happened to that other 350? That's what I'm here to talk about today, because although, you know, the city gave us a small goal, we exceeded that goal. But out of the 9,000 prisoners and 98% of them with a outdate, 4,500 of those are going to come back to the Twin Cities because they're half of the population is in St. Paul and Minneapolis. We have a very daunting scenario to look at. But just not that. Think about the last 15 years of people who went through the criminal justice system. Now, that number is more daunting simply because they never got a chance to get the contact, in some cases, with the criminal justice system off of their records. Some have never been convicted, never been indicted. They only had contact. So when I run a criminal history, the BCA rolls, it rolls people who have had contact. Subsequently, employers are doing that as well. I like to just make a note of that. I think it was the gentleman from the Chamber of Commerce that said that there is no cause relationship between a person running a criminal history and not being able to get a job. That is patently untrue. I see it every day. Simply because they run that BCA, not because they were indicted or convicted, but because they had contact, they are literally seen as a problem relative to employment. And finally, most people don't really realize that if you actually give people an opportunity, especially this particular population that we're talking about, a chance at working, at a job opportunity, an employee of record, they will flourish. They will do very well, contrary to popular belief. So we're here to support this particular bill. I think last time I was here, it was in March. I said I had not come to bury this bill, but to praise it. I think even in this situation, I've definitely... I'm glad that the type of leadership that's being taken on this issue is one that shows a very great deal of compassion. I think it's very courageous. And please support this bill. Thank you.
If there's any further questions. Is there a motion?
Mr. Chairman, I'd move that Senate File 3035 as amended be recommended to pass.
Discussion on that. Oh, seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? No. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members,
you're welcome.
For your time.
We're kind of doing all right. We got about 7 more to go, and we might not have to come back tonight. Number 3 on the agenda, Senate File 3003, Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members
and
of the committee.
Mr. Jones is one of your witnesses, too?
No.
Oh, no.
He's not enough for 1 week, thanks.
You're not in a fertilizer bill, huh, Jones? Okay, Senator Roebling. Okay.
Thank you. Senate File 3003 is a bill that kind of is a follow-up on the legislation we passed a number of years ago that placed a ban on phosphorus fertilizer, lawn fertilizer. And one of the things that came up, and this happened last spring several times as my husband and I were in retail stores standing near fertilizer displays because we were picking some up ourselves as we were establishing some new lawn. And we realized that people did not appear to understand the law that there was really a ban on phosphorus fertilizer unless you had the exceptions. And so I was doing a little research on it and found out that the Department of Ag had put out a report that had been required after the law was passed. And one of the recommendations that they made in there that was that we have continuing consumer education about the use of phosphorus lawn fertilizer. And then I was reading the League of Cities book of recommendations for legislative action this year, and I came across a recommendation from them that also said that they would like to see continuing consumer education on this issue. And so I put together this bill and brought along a sample of the sign that we would like to have required in retail establishments that are selling phosphorus fertilizers. And the bill simply states that the wholesalers who are providing the fertilizers to the stores would give their retailers a sign. And the Department of Ag has been very helpful with this. And in fact, they will have this, if we pass it, posted on their website for any business or wholesaler to download so that they would have this readily available. The actual language in the bill would be able to fit on an 8x10 like this. This would be the 3/8 inch type. The Department of Ag took it one step further and provided an educational opportunity here to help consumers understand how to read the fertilizer bags so that consumers would understand that this middle number in the fertilizer digits here would have to be a 0 to be a phosphorus-free fertilizer. And so this is very helpful. It's not mandated in the legislation, but this would be something that the Department of Ag would make available to retailers.
Senator Roebling, who are the retailers on this? Not that that's going to influence us, but I was just wondering if everybody's on board or
Mr. Chairman,
you know?
We did have the bill heard in the Ag Committee, and no one came forward.
Is there anybody in the audience wish to testify against it? Okay, we can hear a couple words. I don't think we have to. If there's no opposition, I think we can move a little quicker on this. And Ms. O'Rourke, did you wish to say a couple words?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jennifer O'Rourke with the League of Minnesota Cities, and we're in total support of the bill Roebling's brought before you today.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, I have a question because I recall this bill in front of us several years ago, and I thought it was kind of silly because you couldn't even have fertilizer, like, spilling over onto your sidewalk or your driveway, and I didn't want there to be fertilizer police, you know, in my community. And I recall voting against that bill, but you're not doing anything with that language. So can you clarify, can we use fertilizer with phosphorus or not?
Sir, but yes.
I thought we couldn't.
Mr. Chair, and Senator Scheid, I should pass this around perhaps. There are exceptions. Okay. If you're establishing a new lawn with seed or sod, if your soil has been tested and it's deficient in phosphorus, you can use the phosphorus-based fertilizer. If it's applied on a golf course by a trained person or applied on farms growing sod for sale. So there's a number of exceptions. So it's not illegal to sell the phosphorus-based fertilizer. And so it's out there in the retail stores. It's just that so many people don't know that it isn't, you know, what the state expects. And there are exceptions. And if you're putting in a new lawn, you can certainly use it. And we haven't had any phosphorus police out there, really. I know some of the cities are quite interested in it. In Savage, for example, where I represent that community, we have the Savage Fen. And our communities actually make quite an effort to try and keep this in front of the public because they want to make sure that people aren't using phosphorus fertilizer on their lawn, which could affect the fen. Or in Prior Lake, the city of Prior Lake once in a while puts out in their city newsletter reminders about the ban. But people standing in the store, unless they've seen that, and they're a new homeowner, they moved into the state, or the law was passed 3-4 years ago, and there was some media attention to it then, but now so many people aren't even aware of it.
So,
okay. Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, I appreciate the bill because then when I go, I will understand what the law is. And so...
Plus, it's bigger type now.
It's important, Mr. Chair. I recall that we had a bill, and I don't know if it was Senator Roebling who had the bill about the light bulbs,
the signage for light bulbs. Isn't that Senator
Marty? And the retailers were concerned about that. And so when you asked that question, I thought about this. But I certainly would like this information posted. It would be helpful. So I need all the help
Senator,
I can get.
Any further discussion by the panel? Senator Koch, did you wish to move the bill?
Move the bill.
Further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, signify by aye.
Aye.
And aye. Opposed, motion prevails. Thank you, folks. Go into the floor. Senator Torres Rey is number 4 on our agenda, Senate File 3669. Welcome to the committee. Good to see you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members of the committee. This is my first time in your committee, so thank you for the opportunity.
Welcome.
I am very pleased to be here and ask for your support to address a significant problem that took place in my district, is taking place in many districts, and some construction projects take place in Minnesota. It's probably going to impact every district in the state of Minnesota. And this Senate File 3669, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, intends to it requires that the Commissioner of Transportation will create a report that will be coming to the legislature proposing a program to mitigate the impact of transportation construction projects on small businesses. This bill was heard yesterday in the Transportation Committee, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. And some members of the Transportation Committee had some questions around about the language, and for them it was a little bit confusing. As they read the language, the language was not clear about the responsibilities of the Commissioner and of Transportation and the Commissioner of the Department of Economic Development. And in order to address their concerns, I have an amendment that put the language in the shape that I think most members will be more comfortable with. And that is, I believe, the A1 amendment.
This is language that you and the Transportation Committee worked on, and you got...
Correct, Mr. Chair.
People are on board.
And your staff as well. So they both help with this process just to make sure that the language is clear.
Okay, any discussion on that? Senator Tomasoni moves the A1 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion prevails. Further discussion. This bill went through the Transportation Committee yesterday, and it calls for a report. Is that correct?
Correct, Mr. Chair.
So any Senator Torres-Ray?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, with me I have Mr. Eric Nathanson, who works with the Metropolitan Consortium of Community Developers, to speak about this issue and to explain, to give you a sense of some of the issues that they have faced and how they have helped small businesses in the past, particularly my district where I had some small businesses dealing with significant changes and how they were able to support those small businesses during this process.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the chance to appear before you. I will be very, very brief. I'm Eric Nathanson. I'm finance coordinator with the Metropolitan Consortium of Community Developers, MCCD. We're a nonprofit business development group that provides access to capital and technical assistance for small businesses in the metro area. Over the last few years, we've worked with a group of businesses in Minneapolis that have been impacted by transportation projects, and we've learned some lessons that I think would be useful to the departments as they comply with the report requirements. I guess the main point I'd like to make to the committee and to the department is that what we found is really important is for businesses to get advanced information about these projects and how it will affect them. We then have been able to come in and help the businesses do some planning, prepare for what could be a temporary turndown in sales. We have used DEED's Urban Initiative Program to provide some short-term cash flow loans to businesses, very small loans for the very smallest, most vulnerable businesses. We think it's really important to have one-on-one conversations with businesses in advance of the projects so they're prepared for these projects, and that certainly can help ease the pain substantially. So we feel that this is a useful step forward, and we'd certainly be glad to answer any questions that you might have.
Personally, I think this is you're on the right track here. I'm from out in Mendota, way in Mendota Heights, and they closed that high bridge the Mendota Bridge. And literally a couple of restaurants went out of business down in Mendota, the small village of Mendota. And I think something like this would have helped, whether it be financial or telling them up front of the timing, how long this thing's going to take. And they're out of business, So I guess this doesn't hurt to the extent and the nature of the taking and the timing and whether there's some stopgap money or something. So any further discussion? Senator Carlson.
Mr. Chair and Senator Torres-Ray, what's the scope of project that is included here? How small can they be?
Senator Carlson, I think that is defined in statute, and I work with Mr. Fuller last night because that was a question that we had, that you had, Senator Saltzman had in the Transportation Committee. So the amendment that I provided that you just passed actually defines the size of the businesses, and that is defined in statute right now. So I'm not fully familiar with it, but we need to comply with the current definition of small businesses that is currently in statute. So I think Mr. Fuller can help us with that.
Senator Carlson.
Mr. Chair and Senator Torres-Ray, I'm wondering the size of the transportation project, not the size of the business. The transportation, if we were talking about, for instance, closing a driveway for some small project, or are we talking about, for instance, Highway 61? That's obviously the large one, but if we're talking about a small project, how small does this go down to?
Well, that'd be it anyway.
Mr.
Chair, Senator Carlson, I think our intent when this when we were talking to Senator Torres Rey about this project, we'd have the department sort of designate impact zones, so the department would make some determination that the project was substantial enough to really have an impact on a number of businesses, obviously a driveway closing or one street.
Yes.
But we would leave it up to the department to come up with some standards on where the project would have some substantial impact on businesses in a community.
Senator Carlson.
And Mr. Chair and Senator Torres Rey or your guest, can the small businesses request this type of study and information? For instance, if I'm a small business and I know that my highway is going to undergo some changes, and I don't know the extent of the changes, and I don't know the extent of the length of time, but it appears like this may not fall under that category that the Transportation Department is going to select for looking at it. Can I request that?
Can I try to answer a little bit? I think that's what the report is getting after, to set up criteria and issues and that you're asking for, Senator Carlson. Is that correct, Senator? I mean, we don't know yet everything that's going to be in here. That's why you want to do this. That's what I get out of it.
That is correct, Mr. Chairman and Senator Carlson. For some of the business owners that are really more attentive and they know that this is going to happen, obviously today they can request that information. And they don't need this type of – we don't need this type of legislation. But the problem is that the overwhelming majority of businesses really are not aware that these projects are going to take place. And so what we want to do is really be proactive and really let them know ahead of time so that they can prepare and then work with organizations like Mr. Nathan's organization so that they can acquire the information, find out if they are eligible for some kind of loan so that they can do advertising, really be prepared for that particular time. And in some projects, like in my district, some of the projects were scheduled to be completed in a year, and they took over 2 years. And so for small businesses, this is really a tremendous burden. So we want to make sure that we are proactively providing that information for businesses. And, of course, right now they could request that information for those who really know what is happening. But many do not know, really, that this is coming. And I think what I learned through the experiences in my district is that many of the small business owners ask after it is too late, and they are really struggling. You know, they've been dealing with this problem for a year, and then they begin to ask, you know, what is available to me, where should I go, how long this project is going to go. But many times they are just asking the question too late, so we want to be more proactive. And
it seems to me the timing of this, whether you voted for or against the transportation bill, is timely because there will be hopefully a lot more projects in the stream. And people want to know, you know, out in Dakota County, there's going to be an acceleration of, and your folks in the business community, Senator Carlson, would get a heads up, the way I understand it, would be part of the, hopefully, the report. So that's Senator Tomasoni.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Torres Rey has been talking to me about this for a while, and I think the bridge probably had some impact on your area also. And I know that people have been saying that bridge being down is like a $400,000 a day economic impact on the metropolitan area. But what I'm wondering, and I think this is maybe for your witness, Mr. Nathanson, there's something called business interruption insurance, and I don't know if that really helps businesses a lot or if it gets them through the tide. Do you know that if a small business were not insured, and I think maybe this might be something that your study might want to look at. If you're not insured at the time that the transportation department announces a project, can they get the insurance and have it actually be valid? Do you know anything like that?
So you want to try that?
Before the project starts, but after the project has been announced.
Mr. Nathanson.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Tomasoni, I'm not familiar with the specifics of that. That's certainly something that we'd want to explore in a toolkit for businesses. Typically, the very smallest businesses that we deal with tend to be not really sophisticated. They're little mom-and-pop businesses, and they're not likely to know about this kind of insurance. But this is something that we could certainly help educate them if we know that there is a project coming down the line.
And Mr. Chairman and Senator Tomazoni, our conversations actually trigger that language that is in here because when you and I talk about this, I understood that there was a really big need to connect the two commissioners so that they can really communicate with one another and let each other know about these different programs that are available to businesses, because that's precisely what we want to do. We want to make sure that this information is available to them ahead of time so that they can prepare. So that absolutely will be part of what we expect be included in the report.
She's a good listener, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Tomazoni or Senator Carlson, would you like to
move
the bill?
Yeah.
Senator Tomazoni. Any further discussion on the bill? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We
Thank
might
you,
go just a little out of order. I have to sit here anyway, but I've got to we think, I think, six, the is a repealer on a sunset date. My bill, or not my bill, the bill I'm carrying, and Senator Sparks' bill, 2830, is also a repealer on a sunset date, and I think they're, after you hear from us, I think you'll find that there's no reason to have a sunset date on those two. So I'd like to take those in a hurry. I think Senator Pappas' might take a little longer, so that's why we're going to wait for hers to the end. So, Senator Salzman.
Because it's Petrofund, I think it's Department of Commerce.
It is Commerce, so we just couldn't figure out why we had to deal with
Petrofund
and
see if it's Commerce.
It is Commerce. Thank you.
Yeah, that's what
we're going to do.
So Senate File 3147, Senator Metzen.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair and members. 3147 deals with the blind and disabled persons' accessible electronic information service expiration date. This bill deals with access to news services for the blind and for the deaf and hard of hearing in Minnesota. Services include a dial in a news service, closed captioning, local markets. The money to fund these programs is out of the TAM fund, and this is ongoing assessments that there's about $4 or $5 million in that fund, so it doesn't come out of the general fund, and so there's a stream of payments already in the pipeline to take care of the blind and the deaf for these services, so it's not an additional tax. What we're trying to do today, and these services have worked very, very well for the last 4 or 5 years that I'm aware of. And the people I'm trying to help here always get a little nervous because, you know, are we going to be cut off at the legs next year? And so we'd like to just remove the sunset out of successful programs that are working, and that's what the bill does. And so I've got people from the deaf and hard of hearing group out here, and I've got some people from the Director of the Blind Services if you'd like to hear from them, but I think essentially what I said is
it's pretty much the bill. Very good.
Pretty much is a bill. And
is there discussion? Any questions? Senator Gerlach.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Metzen, generally I think sunsets are a good idea to essentially I think you agree with that, that they without passing judgment on the programs or what's going on, they allow us as a legislature for a chance after, you know, a few years to look and evaluate, review, and it allows us to make any changes. Maybe it's a nice little check-in type of a thing. So I'm wondering, I mean, I see the value of the programs here, but
yeah, I don't know if I'm comfortable. You and I, quite frankly, have agreed on that over the years, but on this one, these two, I think we can make a case that they really work. I mean, there's a way to dial in. There's ways to get the closed captions. And for this part of our society, just in this, not, but to be on edge all the time, wondering if they're going to have these services year in and year out. So this one, Senator Gerlach, I would hope we could make an exception for. But generally speaking, I'm with you on taking a peek at things every 2, 3, 4 years, but not this one.
Any other questions? Senator, would you like to move Senate File 3147? Senator Tomasoni moves Senate File 3147. Are there any questions?
I know. I wanted you to move it.
I want to make sure it passes.
You, Senator. So on Senator Tomasoni's motion, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign, and the motion prevails.
Thank you. And I think Senator Sparks has hopefully an easy one, too.
Senator Sparks, Senate File 2830. This is on payroll card accounts and report requirements, provisions, expiration date, repeal. Welcome, Senator Sparks.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. And this bill has been before you, I think, the last 3 years. Senate File 2830 is a payroll card bill. It was first introduced in 2005. The agreed parties worked on it and allows workers to get paid with a payroll card. We found that it's good for workers. The program is totally voluntary. We extended the sunset 2 times, similar to what Senator Gerlach talked about, just to make sure that we weren't catching anyone negatively. We've had no complaints. In fact, last year I required them to do a study. I'm not aware of any opposition. This is model language that's been used around the nation, and I would just ask for member support.
And is there discussion on Senate File 2830 for Senator Sparks? I'm sorry. Senator Gerlach.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Sparks, you just heard our previous discussion, Senator Metzen said that in this case his was a special case. Can you tell us why is this a special case that doesn't require review into the future?
Madam Chair and Senator Gerlach, I think you bring up a good point, and I think that maybe other members should take a look at this too. But we did pass this in 2005. We extended the sunset not only once but twice to make sure there was no negative effects. At this point, we found that there have been no complaints. There's no problems with the program, so I think this committee has more important issues to do than to have me come back every year and extend the sunset.
Is there other discussion?
Well, Madam Chair?
Senator Gerlach.
Senator Sparks, can we just do a I just don't like to put things continually on autopilot. Can we just say 4 years? That way it's not every year, but 4 years and allow it
Madam Chair and Senator Gerlach, we Senator passed Sparks. The bill in 2005. It's good for workers. It's voluntary. We required them to do a study. We've had no complaints.
Well, Madam Chair, I guess
if you want to sit here and argue about it, we certainly can.
Well, I don't want to argue. I just want to make sure we aren't just throwing away proper oversight. I mean, Senator Sparks is not open to that. I'm not going to, put up a big stink about it. I think our committee should look carefully at the fact that if we're just tossing out sunsets. Sunsets are good public policy for oversight of programs that we have, and we shouldn't just throw them out because things seem to be working fine. But.
Well, we'll look forward to having sunsets on all of your legislation in the future then, Senator Gerlach. So any other discussion? On that, Senator Sparks, would you like to move Senate File 2830?
Sure, Madam Chair. I'd move that Senate File 2830 be recommended to pass and sent to the floor. Or want to put on the consent calendar, Senator Metzen?
Absolutely.
Fine with me. Hey, Madam Chair, did we put mine on the consent calendar?
No, we didn't. Should we should we go back and do that? No.
Want to argue this one on the floor?
So Senator Sparks has moved Senate File 2830 for the consent calendar. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. And the motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much.
Senator Koch.
Senator Koch.
Then me.
Senator Koch has Senate File 3055, Military Reservist Economic Injury Loan Program.
Not yours on the consent calendar?
Seems like that.
Did you say? Not yours on the consent calendar?
Yeah. Do we have to redo it then or something?
No, I want to. She knows.
You don't even know what it is.
I know, but I want to do it.
Welcome, Senator Koch.
Well, Madam Chair, committee members. Senate File 3055 is part of the Governor's Veterans Initiative. There are three parts. And basically what we're trying to do here, we're just trying to make it a little easier to employ reservists. And we're also, obviously, all of us want to make sure that when the men and women come home that they're a little easier to find employment. And that's what these three initiatives do. I think they're great. The three parts are, the first is a no-interest loan to small businesses, 20 or less, for if they have a key employee or the owner of the business is deployed and there's economic injury to the company, these no-interest loans would help those companies out. The second part allows someone who's been has just been it allows veterans into the dislocated workers program, which is I'm actually surprised that they're not there already, but within 36 months they can be in the dislocated workers program. And then the third part just creates a small pool within the UI benefits to help employers, where they have a reservist deployed. In the meantime, for that year, year and a half, whatever it is, they hire a temporary worker. And then, of course, when the reservist comes home, they lay the temporary worker off. And this pool would just help to sort of ease that burden for those employers. So.
Okay.
Oh, yes. And then I do have a very small amendment that we need to make, Madam Chair.
Okay. We have a technical amendment. I believe it's the A2 amendment.
Correct.
Would you like to move that amendment?
And I will move the A2 amendment. Members, all this does is, as part of the loan program, there's wording that says including principal and interest. Obviously, these are no-interest loans, so that wording doesn't make any sense.
Okay. Senator Koch has moved the A2 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. And the it prevails. Motion prevails. Great. We have some people here today to testify. If you'd like to introduce yourselves. For the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Colonel Eric Allness, Department of Military Affairs. And just briefly, a little bit about why we're coming through and looking at this from the employer perspective. From the military and the bills that you've seen in recent years, a lot of times they focus on the service member themselves. But as we have service members deploying and redeploying over the years, we're finding really there's three aspects that are critical to make sure that we can make these deployments successful and help that warrior come back and become a citizen. And that's we have to address the needs of the service member, the needs of the family, and the needs of the employer. And this one directly goes to the needs of the employer. And that's why we applaud the Yellow Ribbon Task Force, DEED coming forward and working, along with employers coming forward, identifying what are some of those gaps, things would make it easier. So we appreciate the whole team coming together and helping resolve this issue for the veterans, their families, and employers.
Excellent. Thank you.
I'm Charles Schaefer from the Department of Economic Development, and I just want to echo everything that the Colonel has said here.
Very good. Is there any other discussion on Senate File 3055, Senator
Rosen?
I'm on a decongestant, so Senator Rosen, I'm sorry.
Senator Koch, was your witness on the front page of the Star Tribune this week?
I know.
The Colonel?
Sure Madam Chair, Senator, I don't think so.
Okay. All right.
Is that the post office? Post office, front page.
It's Mrs. Bill.
Look, it's fine.
I will check
like
them.
This one's got to come to finance. This one's got money.
Okay, on Senate File 3055.
Madam Chair?
Yes? I'm sorry, Senator Carlson.
Madam Chair, and Senator Colt, this is $20,000. Up to $20,000 per borrower, and the appropriation is $1 million.
Is there money in there?
It's only 50. Is that enough?
Or just owning, maybe.
Mr. Chairman, members, Senator Carlson, we don't have an absolute number in terms of identifying small businesses that are either owned and operated by returning reservists or on which reservists are those returning reservists are key employees. Historically, throughout the country, the few states that do have these programs have a substantially smaller limitation, usually $10,000. And we thought that $20,000 would accommodate the fact that these are targeted towards businesses that are really having substantial difficulties. They can't pay the rent sort of things. I don't know that all of them will be $20,000. There may be some that are substantially smaller. I think that 50 is a good number to start with in terms of the number of potential applicants.
And, Madam Chair, I don't know if this also fills in gaps basically in the larger federal program, which is specifically why it's no interest loans instead of grants. If they were grants, then those would be considered an asset to the federal program. We want them to not be considered that. So it's really sort of the state's fill-in for the gaps in the federal program is really the intention, Senator Carlson.
Okay.
Okay. And Senator Sparks had a question.
Madam Chair, just a quick question because I know we'll see this bill again in Senator Thomasoni's committee. I'm just wondering if it's an interest-free loan. I'm supportive of this of your idea, Senator Koch, and maybe your witness. How do we keep that $1 million whole, though, for not charging any interest to the borrowers?
Well, they'll be paying.
Well, hopefully they'll be paying it back, Senator. I mean, the terms of and meaning the term length of the loans and the terms of the individual loans, are all going to be defined by rule. So the intent is there to define those in rule, and then to have those funds, as they are paid back, go directly into the fund.
Back in.
And then Senator Murphy has a question.
Not so much a question, Madam Chairman, but Senator Sparks. Senator Sparks, the GI Bill is a very successful program because military people pay back their obligations, period. And, you know, I think that this is clearly a step in the right direction. And you give, you know, these military people a little, leg up and getting back in onto solid ground, and they're going to pay this money back, period. And that's just the way things are.
Mm-hmm.
They pay their loans back.
That's very good. Any other questions? Well, Senator Koch, would you like to move Senate File 3055 as amended?
I'd like to move it, and I guess we're on to state and local government.
I believe state and local government.
That's fine. As long as you got to come eventually to me, though.
Okay.
Eventually. Oh, yes. After state and local.
Eventually.
We'll be
okay. So we'll be on the amendment. So to move Senate File 3055 to local government and operations. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. And the motion prevails.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair.
Senator Tomasoni.
May I reconsider the vote on Senate File 3147? As being recommended to pass, so that we can then move it to the consent calendar on a further motion.
Do I need to make two? We can do that. Is everyone in favor of that? Could we have a vote again? Okay, we are going to reconsider Senate File 3147. This is the Metzen Bill on Blind and Disabled Persons Accessible Electronic Information. The expiration date, and this will be to pass the bill and move it to the consent calendar. Correct? Okay, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. And the motion prevails.
Now we make the motion.
Madam Chair, now we need to make the motion to put it on the consent calendar.
Okay, now we're going to make a motion to move this to the consent calendar. Is there any discussion? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. And the motion prevails.
Your case.
Is that right?
Next.
And Tom, in
let's do your case.
Okay, we'll hear Senate File 973, Senator Tomasoni, on state involvement in international trade policies. And I believe you have two people who will be joining you at the table today.
She's got it worked out.
Madam Chair, I have an A1 amendment that I'd like to put on the bill to get it in the shape I'd like to have it in.
Very good.
So I'd like to move that just to start with.
On this badge.
We are looking for the amendment, Senator Tomasoni.
Do you not have it?
We are not sure if we have it. We don't think we have it. Can we start discussion on the bill while we...
I got it here so if someone can get copies of it. Okay. I can tell you what it is. Madam Chair, Senate File 973 was before the committee last year, and we actually passed a version of it out and in the omnibus bill. And it was what it's dealing with is how the state should get involved with international trade agreements. And what we did last year was form a group of interested parties and wanted them to come back with a recommendation to the legislature on the best way to do this. Ultimately, what happened was that the report was due, I believe, on December 15th of 07, and the group had only met once and, due to several different complications, only met one more time after that. And we're in the process of coming up with some recommendations, but these recommendations would then need to get passed through the legislature. And so what I'm doing here today is my amendment will essentially take out the job of the Department of Administration in here and also keep this bill alive so that when the study group does finally come through with some recommendations, we can actually put it into law. But if we don't do it before committee deadlines, I don't know if we have anything going for us here. And Brad Ladle, who has been participating in the study, he can elaborate a little bit more on this and tell you exactly what's going on.
Thank you, Madam
Mr.
Chair.
Mr. Leto.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Senators. Again, my name is Brad Leto, Chief of Staff for the Minnesota AFL-CIO. And Minnesota AFL-CIO does support Senate File 973. And as I'll jump around a little on my testimony here, but as Senator Tomasoni did mention, there was a language put in for a 17-member working group on trade policy last year, and there is a single point of contact, as it's called under the United States Trade Representative system. And there's one person in the state of Minnesota that has that information goes to on trade agreements, and he had some illness and also was out of state on a trade mission with the governor, and so it was very difficult for him to call meetings. They actually are having their last meeting was supposed to be a couple weeks ago to look at the draft recommendations, and they are actually meeting right now. But as Senator Tomasoni says, with the committee deadline, it's a little difficult to do anything. I'll just kind of briefly go. I mean, you know, we didn't come to this legislation lightly last year when we proposed it. And it was an attempt to shed more light on the trade decisions that we kind of think are made in a vacuum. And decisions that, again, affect our economy, the state economy, and specifically our government procurement laws. In fact, I don't know if any members of the committee know that Minnesota is one of six states that withdrew its consent of CAFTA. We certainly didn't know when we started this process that they did. For information purposes, those six states are Iowa, Maine, Missouri, Oregon, Pennsylvania, and, yes, Minnesota. Again, which no one knew. And I guess the other thing is, do any members of the committee know that the country of Australia has asked the state to sign on an agreement that will affect our procurement laws? The trade representative for the state has actually delayed that and doesn't quite, and actually I think would, you know, when he testifies later, or if he, you know, later on if the department does, I know that he said, you know, he kind of could use more input in that decision. He's actually held them off on a decision on that. And, of course, once again, we knew nothing of Australia's request until I spoke with, and it's Mr. Tony LaRusso last year. And, in fact, did anybody on the committee know that we actually have a single point of contact on trade in the state of Minnesota, which is Mr. Tony LaRusso? And we do not – we will not, and I mean no disrespect, and do not pick on him at all, because he's been very helpful. He's been very open with us. But the fact of the matter is he feels that he needs more assistance as well or information, and it would be helpful. So for these reasons, the Minnesota AFL-CIO did pull back on legislation last year and agreed to the working group system. And as I said, you know, it's been unfortunate that the work was somewhat delayed. However, there were a draft report that was looked at the second meeting, and one of the recommendations, there was a few recommendations, but one of them was that the state legislature look at and weigh in on trade agreements and approve trade agreements. Another one was for an advisory council. There was a lot of, from a number of sides, from business and other sides, there was disagreement on that. I don't know what they're deciding right now on that issue. And then there was a single point of contact information from Mr. LaRusso that suggested, you know, he could inform more people. I didn't know exactly how to write that because that hadn't been written yet. So that's why we centered on this amendment, which would basically make the bill take all of the other sections out, but just leave in the section that the state legislature would weigh in on trade agreements. So what we did discover via the work group, though, was that most in the state do not know an impact of trade agreements on the state, and especially our procurement system. The single point of contact in the state is somewhat isolated in the whole trade arena, and does believe there's room for improvement involvement. And like I said, I don't want to speak for him, but that seemed to be the sense. And finally, numerous other states have found similar problems and are acting right now to protect trade laws and or state laws and trade policies. Some of those states are Colorado, Hawaii, Indiana, Maine, New Hampshire, Pennsylvania, Rhode Island, and Utah. And they go all the way from resolutions to Pennsylvania, which has created a separate office to involve citizens in trade discussions and have them all weigh in before to a couple of states that actually have the legislature deciding. So it's actually an issue that certainly has been coming up, and it's especially, like I say, on procurement laws. And with the amendment, like I said, one of the section that would be left in Senator Thomasoni's bill is just the legislative approval portion. And we would again, and of course, we would remain open to incorporating other recommendations should they come out of the working group today, or looking at them, certainly. So anyways, we do the Minnesota AFL-CIO and its 900-plus affiliated union state councils, area labor councils, and central labor councils support 973 to ensure that the state laws can be protected and are indeed protected from unfair competition, especially where it relates to procurement. And I'm happy to respond to any questions you have. Thank you very much.
Okay. We do have the A1 here. Now, Senator Thomas, do you want to move that?
I want to move that so I get it in the form that I'd like to have the bill in.
Okay, Senator moves the A1 amendment. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign, and the motion prevails. So Senator Thomasoni, are there questions?
Madam Chair.
To Senator Scheid.
Madam, excuse me. Yes. So essentially, Senator Thomasoni, what we have left is the legislative approval of trade agreements, international trade agreements.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Madam Chair. And okay. Senator Scheid, I got to point out that I had this before the committee last year. It ended up in the omnibus bill as a study group, and there were I think 17 people on the study group, and we had all kinds of trouble getting together because of different complications. And there was a report due. It was either November 15th or December 15th. I think it was December 15th. We didn't even come close to getting that done. The group's meeting today, and the idea was to send a recommendation back to the legislature as to how this should actually be done and what would be the best way. And one of the things that they're considering right now is the legislature should approve any of these trade agreements. And what I'm trying to do is keep this bill alive so that if they ever do get a report out, that we can actually then put it into this bill.
Madam Chair.
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, did you say how many trade agreements we have?
I guess I don't know that. You know that, right?
And would this be ones that just affected Minnesota, or would this be like NAFTA?
Madam Chair, Senator Scheid, there are a number of, we've already signed off, the state has already signed off on NAFTA, the WTO agreements.
But
nations that are part of the WTO agreements, we can't, automatically, because we've signed on to those, the governor has signed on to them, governors in the past, I'm sorry, have signed on to those, we can't have any. So if it's an agreement with one of the WTO nations, and there's 30-some, we can't have an impact on that. Future ones, like when CAFTA was, we withdrew on the governor's office, withdrew our any agreement with CAFTA on that, and that, so those provisions would not apply, the Central America Free Trade Agreement, those provisions would not apply to our, especially our procurement laws. This would then, any other one that came in, would the legislature would then weigh in, and I think the language, it calls for at least one public hearing before the legislature weighs in.
So, Madam Chair,
Senator Scheid,
does this apply only then, Mr. Leto or Senator Thomasoni, to procurement issues? No.
Madam Chair, Senator Scheid, not necessarily. The fact of the matter is that's mostly what it's going to end up applying to. But, could the legislature in other states, what they're doing is they're looking at their, in essence, it becomes, I suppose you could say it almost becomes a resolution on the other issues, because we can't impact other laws. The only ones that we can protect are pretty much state procurement laws, although the department may mean a little more, but it's basically procurement laws. I suppose you could argue or say that it then looks we're making recommendations just in general on trade policy, which a lot of other states are doing, and more and more states are starting to do, and I think to encourage more involvement from the federal government with states on those issues before they actually sign them.
Okay, a question from Senator Michelle.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Are we going to hear from Mr. LaRusso? Aforementioned.
We certainly can. If there's other people to testify, certainly.
He's on our list, I saw.
Okay.
Is he here? He might not be here.
He's unable to be here, I understand. Matt,
he's probably meeting right now with the working group that I'm talking about that's going to come back with the recommendation. But I'm just trying to see. We'd like to actually put the recommendations of the working group into a bill form. But since we've had so many delays and since it hasn't worked, and we haven't gotten to the point where we actually have one, if this bill is alive, then I can at least amend it, the recommendation of the working group onto it.
Madam Chair, just on
Senator Michelle.
On this point, on our missing witness, Senator Tomsoni or Mr. Leto, could you say that Mr. LaRusso would support this language?
Well, go ahead. What do you think?
Madam Chair,
I guess you could say.
Senator Michelle. I can say, and in fact, I don't have I hesitated to deliver copies of the draft recommendations but I do have copies of the draft recommendations. One of the draft recommendations was to have the legislature weigh in and approve trade agreements. Actually, there was not a lot of discussion at the last meeting that I attended just as a spectator because there are actually business representatives, labor representatives I was just a monitoring it, I guess, if you will. There was more discussion on creating a task force to advise the there was more discussion on that than there was actually the approval. Now, I'm not going to say that are they going to come out with that today, but there was not a lot of discussion on that issue at the last meeting, which was the second meeting that I can, and that was in the draft recommendations. Is it going to be in the final ones? There were four recommendations in the draft ones. One was an advisory council. Two was having the state approve trade agreement, the legislature weigh in and approve trade agreements. Three was having the single point of contact, Mr. LaRusso, inform more state agencies about this, which I'm not sure there's language necessarily needed for that. And the fourth one was trying to involve more people as appointments to the national panels. There's national panels on trade, which require an extensive background check. In fact, Mr. LaRusso, I think, has been in a process of somewhere between a 3 and a 6 month background check. That's how long it takes. So have any idea how to put that language in, especially with federal background checks. So that's what's in the draft recommendations. Distribute it. I hesitate since it's a draft, but.
Senator Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and Mr. Leto, all they need to do is file that $100 fee for public office, and they'll get a background check.
Thank you, Senator Murphy. A question is that I had was, we think about this, over the interim, when we were not in session, we felt there was a need for us to respond to some situations, and we were not called back. Is there ever an issue where a trade agreement would come, say, the day there's, something that happens the day after we adjourn, and we might have to wait 6 or 7 months to come back? Then would that be an issue if we were to be involved in these kind of decisions?
The legislation actually does say that it waits to the next session of the legislature. As a practical matter, I think, and it is unfortunate Mr. LaRusso is not here because he knows all this. I know that somebody is here from the department, I think, that can talk about some of this. I don't know that they have as much knowledge as Mr. LaRusso on this issue, but that, in fact, the Australia request has actually been pending and they're not part of CAFTA, they're not part of ERMI, which we've drew from WTO or anything else. That request has been pending since when I found out last year, which would be a year ago now. In fact, they don't quite, I think, know what to do with it. I think Australia may have finally backed off. They were getting calls weekly from Chicago from the Australian Trade Office, they now have kind of, I think, backed off because there hasn't been a response. So I'm just saying this does happen. I mean, it this was all news to me. I mean, this wasn't when we started delving into this. And like I said, I don't think anybody in the legislature knew. And I think just having even a hearing and having the legislature weigh in on this, I think the public would have some more knowledge and probably good knowledge of trade agreements and what they mean. Not necessarily all bad. I mean, I'm not saying that. So.
I think just to, like, for us to understand what's right. The process and do these things take years or do we miss out on an opportunity? So are there other people here to testify from the department or no one is going to testify? Okay. That's fine. All right. Senator Tomasoni, would you like to move your bill as amended?
As amended, yes, Madam Chair.
Okay, Senator Tomasoni has moved Senate file number 973, which will go to economic development.
Yep. To finance.
Oh, to finance. Okay, back to finance. Although, and is there further discussion? All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. And the motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members.
And next up is Senator Metzen with Senate file 3455, and then we will hear from Senator Pappas. Senate File 3455 is the beer keg purchased by scrap metal dealers regulation.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Senate File 3455, as you said, regulates the purchase and receipt of beer kegs by scrap metal dealers. With the scrap metal prices skyrocketing, people that don't own these kegs are turning them in and making a lot of dough. With this, matter of fact, there's about 400,000 kegs are lost or stolen a year, and they cost about over $50 million to replace these kegs. And this is a situation where the manufacturer, or I should say the brewers, wholesalers, and retailers are all in agreement on this. And Senator, who had the bill last year on that scrap metal?
Senator Higgins.
Senator Higgins' bill, I think it kind of patterns a little bit after that. It has, and this has a huge impact on the brewers, and it's a lot of money, but this attempts to remedy the problem by only allowing scrap dealers to accept kegs from the manufacturer or the brewers. So I think it's pretty straightforward. Again, it's become quite a, and these aren't lost kegs, quite frankly. They're stolen kegs or what, you know. So we think that the rightful owners should be protected with this addendum to the other scrap metal bills that we've looked at in this body. So that's what it does. And I have people that Mr. O'Neill from represents Anheuser-Busch, and we've got the wholesalers are in favor of this. They're not here today, but the retailers are here, and I believe it's not on the tape, but I'll tell the tape that they are not in agreement with this legislation. So.
Very good.
And if you want to hear from them, we can, but that's what the bill does.
Let's ask if there's any questions for Senator Metzen. Senator Scheib.
Yes, Madam Chair, a couple of questions. The first one is, what happens when you get a keg of beer for, you know, a wedding reception or something? You know, I think you would be expected to take it back, but if you don't you lose? Don't you pay a deposit so that in case you didn't take it back? Is that how it
Senator
works?
Metzen.
People are nodding again, Senator Metzen.
We're going to get nods today instead of wonderful testimony. You're getting a good testimony from me, so no.
We had a wonderful moment. It must have been in judiciary last year when Senator Moi did not. It was a cultural thing, and she thought you could nod no. But we all know, you know, that in our culture, you don't nod no.
Yeah.
you know, shake your head no, but you nod yes. So when we say nodding, we mean yes, I guess. But so if a person has one of those lying around and I don't, would they?
They rush down there right away before this becomes law. That's what they do. No, I don't know. I don't know.
And then how does the scrap dealer know that the person bringing it in is a manufacturer or the brewer? And then also, do home brewers use the same kind of keg? And
Madam
no,
Chair,
they're shaking their head no on that. Okay.
Madam Chair, okay. And members of the committee and Senator Scheid, my name is Joe O'Neill. I'm an attorney in St. Paul. Actually, what's happened is a sign of the times. First of all, the kegs do have the brewer's name imprinted on it. And when Senator Scheid, Madam Chair, you or myself or someone gets a keg, we put a deposit down. When we return the keg, we get the deposit back. But some people are taking the beer keg, and they get a lot more by taking it to the scrap dealers. And the scrap dealers have no objection either, because when the beer keg comes to the scrap dealer, it should have the name on it, imprinted on it. It really affects mostly a lot more the small craft brewers and the small ones. They do mostly draft beer. They don't do a lot of bottling and can. And these people have to, every time they lose a beer keg, they have to get another one manufactured, and it costs $150, $175. So this is something that's happening all over the country, and 12 states already have acted with this type of bill. And it really just gives another subdivision to the bill you added last year on scrap metal dealers when you had them register and report and record. This puts a new subdivision and just indicates the only time they can receive one is receive it from the manufacturer or brewer.
So,
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, I think you might still want to, I certainly support doing something here. I just think you might want to find out, or I don't know if you've, maybe you've spoken to the scrap metal dealers. They had quite an organization, I think, that appeared before us last year. Mm-hmm. Just to know how they will know, because even though it's printed on, stamped on the keg, I don't know that they're going to know. I mean, they can probably figure out if it isn't a brewer or a manufacturer, I suppose,
but
I don't know how you would prove.
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Scheid, this is really just a theft of other property, theft of property that has the name on it of the brewer or the manufacturer, and they're turning it into the scrap metal dealers, and they're not in any way connected with the manufacturer or the brewer. This indicates to the scrap metal dealer that you can't accept that. You can only accept it from a manufacturer, someone who indicates that they represent that person, because otherwise you're receiving stolen property that's owned by somebody, the brewer or manufacturer.
No, Madam Chair, and it's very good to see Mr. O'Neill. I haven't seen him for a while.
Thank you.
But I still think there might be – I mean, I don't know, maybe retailers don't take them back to scrap, don't take things to scrap dealers or whatever, but it strikes me that you still have to prove that you're that, and I don't know how the scrap metal dealers will know if you are authorized to do that. I mean, would you be better off just saying we shouldn't let them take them back?
Well, Madam Chair, this is the type of bill that's been passed in the other states, and it allows for when anybody receives a beer keg that you have to show representation that the person who owns the keg, who is the brewer or manufacturer, that you're representing them, and otherwise it's stolen property because they don't own it.
Okay, and a question from Senator Carlson.
Yep. Madam Chair and Senator Metzen, the notion of a keg, I think most of us know what a keg is, and we know that they're refillable. But there are kegs now that you can buy that are not refillable. They're certainly smaller, and I think for the most part it's pretty obvious. But if you're the scrap metal dealer and you're accepting a gallon keg or whatever level they're selling them now, a lot of European beers are brought over here and Japanese beers, and they're calling them a mini keg. And some of them are actually self-contained with a carbon dioxide charge in them. And, I think a scrap dealer needs to know that that this only affects refillable kegs, that a non-refillable keg is still something that they can accept.
Madam Chair and Senator, if you look closely at the bill, it merely talks about shall not purchase or receive a metal beer keg from anyone except the manufacturer or the brewer. So that's what this is for, scrap metal dealers, and it just prohibits them from receiving the stolen property unless the manufacturer, the brewer, has a representative that presents the keg to them for scrap metal.
Senator Carlson.
Yeah, Madam Chair and Mr. O'Neill.
Yes.
Yeah, these are metal also. Mm-hmm. The gallon ones are metal. So there really isn't a differential description other than they're non-refillable.
He's right.
And I'm not sure if those are labeled non-refillable, because I think somebody in the industry would have to tell us that. But I think for the most part, those are labeled non-refillable.
Well, this is merely an attempt to regulate those that have the manufacturer, the brewer's name on it. That's an identification that they're the owner of it, so it's not talking about anything else.
I Madam Chair, I think... talking about
non-refillable ones now. Maybe we could fix that up now, Madam Chair. And
okay.
Yeah, we can put in refillable.
Okay.
Apparently, after on line 19, or receive a refillable, would that do it? Does that sound?
Is that answer, Senator? Mm-hmm.
I think you bring up a good point. But
okay, very good.
A little. We're not after. We're after. Well, we're after these big guys is what I think we're doing. And the big guys like Senator Scoy Johnson in the back row. So, you know.
So, Senator Carlson, would you like to move that amendment to add the word refillable between A and metal on line 1.9?
Madam Chair, sure. I'll move
okay.
that.
Okay. Is there any more discussion on the Carlson amendment? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. And the and it prevails. The motion prevails. On that note, are there any other questions, discussion on this bill? Okay, Senator Metzen, would you like to move?
I'll move the Senate File 3455 as amended.
As amended. And it is going to the floor. Okay. Any other discussion on the motion? Okay. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. And the motion prevails.
I might just maybe from announcement from here, we have the one bill, Senator Pappas, on the agenda. If there's some way, without cutting anybody short, we can get that done by a quarter and a half an hour. We don't have to come back tonight. So,
I want to come.
Unless you want to come back, we can.
I'm sure I'd like to move Senator Pappas.
That being said, Senator Pappas.
I want to move.
We'll try to be as brief as we can, Madam
Chair.
Thank
you, Senator Pappas.
Since this bill did pass out of Commerce Committee with, I believe, no opposition. In 2007, we passed a phase-out of two toxic flame-retardant chemicals called pentan-octa, and we asked the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency to report back in January 2008 on the third remaining flame retardant called DECA. The PC report is in, and it verifies what we said last year, that DECA is causing widespread pollution in Minnesota. Specifically, DECA has been detected in house dust, sediments, sewage sludge, fish, birds, and in human breast milk, fat, and blood, and levels of DECA are increasing. Nursing infants and young children have the highest intake of PBDEs, including DECA. Animal studies associate DECA with an array of health effects, including effects on liver and thyroid and reproductive, developmental, and neurological problems. The fact that around 5% of people carry body burdens that approach the concentrations at which adverse effects are seen in laboratory animals is of concern. Numerous studies demonstrate that DECA breaks down to more toxic forms in the environment. A phase-out of DECA PDE can be accomplished without affecting fire safety. We have several letters in your packet from fire associations, professional fire associations. And because there are effective alternatives for achieving flame retardancy that are available for most DECA applications. So the bill we're proposing is a limited phase out of DECA to reduce home exposures, just home exposures, to better protect children especially. The bill proposes to phase out DECA in electronic enclosures, so that's like television or computer monitors, textiles like rugs and draperies, and mattresses for home use. Other uses in wire and cable and transportation are not included. So, Mr. Chairman, that was just a brief overview on the legislation, and I have Kathleen Schuler, policy analyst from the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy, that can give you some kind of scientific background.
Schuler, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. I'm going to be very brief. You have a PowerPoint of mine, a copy of that in your packet, but I'm not going to do a PowerPoint. I'm just going to highlight some of the points that Senator Pappas didn't already cover. We talked about the fact that the Pollution Control Agency verifies that this is a pollution problem in Minnesota, that these toxic flame retardants are in our fish, they're in our homes, in dust, and they're in our bodies. We did a body burden study here in November, and we, of 35 people that were tested, including Representative Shelley Madure, everyone had the brominated flame retardants in their body, and 34 of the 35 had DECA in their body, so that we know we are exposed to it. The thing is, we don't need DECA. There are safer alternatives. And what's happening now is most electronic companies are already starting to phase it out. 95% of computer companies have already stopped using DECA. We're only regulating in the external casing. And then a lot of the TV manufacturers as well are starting to phase it out. Over 50% of them have already phased it out, and many are online to phase it out by 2010. As far as its use in bedding, it's not widely used in mattresses. What we're trying to do with this bill is to prevent future uses to reduce home exposures so that it wouldn't be used in textiles used in the home and it wouldn't be used in mattresses, because we're particularly worried about children who are exposed to dust and crawl on the carpet and put their fingers in their mouths. And fire safety can be assured without the use of DECA, and it's very clear in the Pollution Control Agency report that we can assure fire safety without using DECA. Thank you.
We got any questions of the author or the witness at this point?
Yes, Chair.
Apparently there's Senator Michelle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Pappas or Ms. Schuler. Have other states moved in this direction on vis-a-vis these chemicals, or where do we line up with other states, and where, what is the federal government doing? I'll add that as well.
Ma'am.
Mr. Chair, Senator, there are two states that have phased out DECA, the state of Washington and the state of Maine. The federal government has not acted yet on the brominated flame retardants.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pappas.
We do have a situation in the EU, though, where I believe they're phasing out DECA by 2012.
Actually, 2010. They have a temporary 2010. Yeah, they have a temporary exemption from the restriction on hazardous substances, which phased out the other two brominated flame retardants in Europe.
Senator Gerlach and then Senator Scoy.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Pappas, when the fire service was here a week or two ago, they had a handout, and one of the bills they were opposed to, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but I thought it was this, because this is a flame retardant, and of course, when you don't have flame retardants on things, they burn, and firefighters tend not to like that. But then someone told me the other day that some fire services were okay with it and some weren't. Where is the fire service world on this bill?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Gerlach, in your packet we have two letters, so we do believe that there is a split on this. But we have a letter of support from the Minnesota Professional Firefighters and from the International Association of Firefighters. They are specifically concerned about dangers to their members when they are trying to put out a fire with their own toxic exposure to what they call a DECA burn in a fire they're attending. So they're concerned about their own exposure to the DECA chemical. And on the International Association of Firefighters letter, the last sentence of the letter said that there are a number of companies that have stopped using brominated flame retardants, such as Dell, Hewlett-Packard, and IKEA. They're using safer alternative fire retardants. These companies demonstrate that alternative flame retardant technologies for achieving fire safety standards do exist and are readily available for other manufactured products.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Gerlach, in other states, the fire departments and the fire chiefs, including Washington and Maine, have supported the bill. For some reason, the fire chiefs in Minnesota are not supporting it.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, do we know why? Is there anybody here from? I don't know if there is or not. I'm just curious to know why.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Gerlach, I had a brief conversation, and they were still they were a little reluctant because they weren't sure about what alternatives were available. And I think that since we have a phase out of several years out, there'll be ample opportunity for companies to kind of retool and incorporate the alternative fire retardants. And they do have to meet fire safety standards.
Okay. Mr. Chairman.
Right, thank you.
Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Schuler, thank you. You brought up the state of Washington, and while we're not the state of Washington, we don't particularly have to pay attention to what they do. I understand you mentioned that they do have a phase-out, but I think it's contingent on a study that's looking at alternatives and other factors, and I was wondering if we were considering anything like that in Minnesota to try to understand what the alternatives are and what the dangers are before we move forward with the phase-out. And I was wondering if you had a comment on that.
That's a fair question.
Mr. Chair, Senator Skoy, in Washington State, I don't believe it's a study. It is a process whereby they examine the alternatives. Washington State, like the state of Minnesota, did have a state agency report on DECA. And at the time, that report was satisfied that there were safer alternatives. But they do have a process they have to go through.
And, Mr. Chair, do you have information about what the process is? Are they fire chiefs or all looking at what the alternatives are before the phase-out takes place? Or
it would be involvement of stakeholders, including the fire community. Yes, those professional firefighters.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Tomasoni.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Pappas, I'm not sure what the right thing to do here is,
Mr. Chairman,
you cannot complete your question.
Let me make a suggestion and see if you're okay with it. Since there's some question as to who thinks it's bad and who doesn't, how about if we extend the date to 2012 instead of 2010?
Maybe she might have had a more different Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Tomasoni and I did discuss this.
Did you?
And the what you want to do, Senator Tomasoni, is on page 2.18 to strike the 2010 and insert 2012, and on 2.28, strike the 2010 and insert 2012.
That would be my motion.
And
Mr.
I think
Chairman.
that might give people a comfort level that we have a couple extra years to make sure that we have the alternatives in place.
Exactly, because there's a few things in here that are exempted, and I understand that has something to do with them being contained. But at any rate,
what I'd suggest, though, and we'll hold your motion, but I'd like to hear from the opposition, get their thinking on the whole bill, plus maybe your amendment, if that's all right with you, Senator Tomasoni.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Pappas, apparently there was the penta and the octa bromodiphenyl ethers were banned last year. Why didn't they try to ban all of it, all three of them together at the same time? Why is DECA now?
Ms. Schuler can respond more completely than me.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rosen, the legislature wanted to, because there was controversy about the science. The opponents were saying one thing and we were saying another. They wanted the Department of the Pollution Control Agency to examine the literature and come back, and so they did. And now we have that report from the Pollution Control Agency.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Rosen.
Ms. Schuler, there's still some controversy, it sounds like. That would be good to extend it out.
Yeah, we're going to try to do this in the next 15 minutes, if possible. We don't want to rush anybody, but Mr. Anderson and Buzz Anderson, did you wish to testify? And I believe there's another name on the Ruiz or something. Laura Ruiz?
Okay.
bring up one person.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Anderson. And you may
thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Buzz Anderson. I'm president of the Minnesota Retailers Association.
What is the real first name? Is it? It's not really Buzz, is it?
It's Fred. No, Mr. Chair. Chair, it's Bruce.
Fred, I've known you for 35 years. And is it Brucey?
Yes.
Bruce, okay.
And there's a great story behind that, but we won't indulge.
Okay, Bruce.
Members, thank you for the opportunity to speak today, and I want to thank Senator Pappas for visiting with me about this bill, and I also want to thank environmental groups for accommodating my concerns about putting the onus of this ban on manufacturers rather on retailers. We, in fact, sell the product. We don't make it, so we want the onus to not be on the retailers. And there is also some language in there to allow us to sell through product that we might also have in inventory. I know that other states have been wrestling with this bill, and some of you have mentioned that. I talked to my counterparts in Washington State to ask what they've done, and I've just had some brief conversation about this. I understand there is an intermediary step before the ban takes place, and my concern was that Minnesota would be the first to do this and that they're that we'd be the only state to do this ahead of other states, which might cause a market disruption. So I'm not really here to talk in opposition to the bill, but rather to say, do we want to put Minnesota in a position of causing a potential market disruption? And probably what Senator Tomasoni is talking about may help resolve this. It is literally in hundreds of products. It is put there as a fire retardant. And I just want to make sure that the committee is able to be assured that if, in fact, we do ban it first in Minnesota, that we can that the marketplace can accommodate, in fact, what actually would be happening with the ban. I'm just raising these questions and hope that the committee and the authors and so on can take that into consideration as they process this bill. We're glad to answer any questions.
Okay, somebody else. Who? Welcome to the committee, ma'am. State your name for the record.
Yes, Mr. Chair. My name is Laura Ruiz. I'm from Albemarle Corporation, which is a manufacturer of flame retardants of all types, and we are also a member of the Citizens for Fire Safety Coalition. I just wanted to touch on a couple of the comments made by Ms. Schuler and comments that were concluded as part of the Minnesota PCA report. Since this bill was last heard last year in Minnesota, the EU, who has done an extensive risk assessment on DECA's environmental and human health impacts, has continued to look at ongoing studies. There were 300 additional studies done since I addressed the Minnesota legislature last year, 300 additional studies reviewed. And as a conclusion to that, in December of 2007, the EU confirmed once again that the risk assessment conclusions still stand. DECA is not in need of further regulation and is considered safe for continued use by the EU Commission. And this is important. There was also a comment made about a temporary exemption. In 2010, it is true that the EU Commission will consider the validity of the exemption currently in place, but this is an ongoing review of not just DECA, but all of the substances contained in the ROS, or Restriction of Hazardous Substances, document in the EU. So this is a regular course of action. They will do it again in 2010, and once again they will look at any new studies that have been put forward between now and then. Another comment that is made quite often is the potential of this product to degrade into other products that have been found to have concerns. Penta and Octa were two products mentioned. Those products have both been removed from the market and are no longer in use. They did have some issues, and the manufacturer of those products voluntarily took those products off the market, and since then many states have banned those products from ever being used. The question about degradation of DECA into those products has been studied. There are numerous studies that show that DECA does not degrade and does not become a significant source of these products in the environment. It's important to note that the substances being found in the environment and those that are contained in the PCA references do not match those that are artificially found in the laboratory. So there's some inconsistency there in the findings. I think it's safe to say that more research is needed. There's enough question. It's a difficult topic to hear in a committee and make a determination about various bodies of science that quite often don't agree with one another. And our industry is committed to continued testing. We support continued testing and transparency of that testing, and we continue to put that forward as we get new tests. And so far, as I mentioned before, none of the tests have concluded that there's significant risk in continued use of this product. I have also included a PowerPoint. You have a packet, I think, that has some data of decabrome and alternatives. I'll just tell you that if you look at some of the key elements of health, human health, exposure, three things need to be mentioned here, and one is persistency, one is bioaccumulation, and another is toxicity. And all three of those need to be looked at very carefully for any alternative, just as they have been looked at for decabrome. And there's some data in there that shows you that one of the alternatives that has been put forward by the state of Maine, which is called RDP, it's a phosphorus-based product, is clearly much more bioaccumulative and considered a concern in that regard than decabrome. And so my conclusion here and the point I want to make is that we have ample evidence that DECA continues to show it can be used safely. We don't have that same evidence for the alternatives and some of the key alternatives that have been mentioned. The state of Washington was mentioned as having put forward a bill that proposes alternatives to decabrome, and that is a fact. In fact, the committee that Washington has put together is made up of the Department of Ecology, Department of Health, and a fire safety committee. And they have to meet and determine whether any alternatives are available, commercially available, that meet the health, environmental, and fire safety aspects that DECA currently has. And if they cannot find any alternatives, then the DECA ban does not go into place. So it is a condition of the Washington State the Washington State bill. So in conclusion, I just want to say that there's never been a person sickened by the use of decabrome, harmed by the use of decabrome, killed by the use of decabrome. We've never had a lawsuit. We've never had anyone in our manufacturing facilities harmed by the use of decabrome. I think it's safe to say that we all know the effects of fire. And the reason the product is in there in the first place is to prevent the fire from happening. And I really do take very seriously the concerns that our firefighters and public safety have. And numerous studies have been done on their exposure to products like decabrome in a fire. And I think you can see from the data that I provided here that the emissions of so many other chemicals that come out in a fire, like polyvinyl chloride and vinyl ester in your siding and your wallpaper are so much greater that any measurable quantities of a product like decabrome are insignificant. And the key, again, is not to have the fire in the first place. That's what you're trying to prevent. So in conclusion, we would strongly urge that the Minnesota legislature consider the same rigorous testing of any alternatives considered before taking any action on an important and proven flame retardant such as decabrome. Thank you.
Questions? Senator Pappas, did you?
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Ruiz? Ruiz was here last year, and it was partly her testimony that created some confusion and uncertainty in the Environment Committee, and so the proposal was that we go to the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency and have them review all the studies. And we did that, and I just want to quote a little bit from their report. Numerous studies have shown that DECA PDE breaks down to more toxic, lower brominated PDBEs in the presence of sunlight, and it can be broken down by metabolic processes in animals and by microorganisms in sewage sludge. That's why we're seeing the presence of DECA in these situations. They also say that a phase-out can be accomplished without affecting fire safety because effective alternatives for achieving flame retardancy are available for most DECA BDE applications. And in general, flammability requirements can be met by using strategies that include using alternative chemical flame retardants, switching to the use of inherently non-flammable materials, and redesigning the product. So we did what the Environment Committee asked us to do. We came back with the information that, yes, this is toxic and alternatives are available. The Environment Committee did not want to see this bill again. They reviewed the report from the PCA. We were heard last Friday in Senator Scheid's committee in the Commerce Committee, and that committee gave this bill its approval. And with Senator Tomasoni's amendment, I'd like to ask for your support.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman. What Senator Pappas says is true about the Commerce Committee, and I wanted to ask if you know anything, or perhaps Ms. Ruiz is the one to ask about the people who work with this. Mm-hmm. I assume that, tell me, do they have to wear masks
No.
and things, and do you let pregnant women work with this, or...
I'm not aware of any pregnant women in our plant that have worked with it, but we don't have any kind of respiratory requirement. The product is safely handled in a plant, good manufacturing practices type environment. Packaging, we have dust filters on our packaging lines anyway. This is a powder, so you would handle it as you would any other powder. But once again, there has not been any reported case of sickness or harm by any of our workers. And this product has been in place and manufactured for over 30 years.
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to...
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to speak in support of Senator Pappas's bill. I just feel that I'm of a generation that started out breathing DDT, and heaven knows what else I have breathed or drunk or eaten and somehow consumed or rubbed on my skin in these... many years I've lived. So I think when we know that something can break down, we know that something can be breathed like this, and you say it's in a powder form, I just think I'd rather err on the side of keeping these things away, especially from vulnerable people, from children and pregnant women, for example. So I think as long as there are safe alternatives, because I understand flame retardants are very important. But we seem to have a new chemical for everything that comes along, and I worry about how many we do breathe and how many we touch and eat and drink. So I've spoken too long. I don't want us to have to come back tonight, but I'd move Senator Pappas's bill. We have an amendment, I think, that we haven't dealt with. Is that
other
right?
Discussion, Senator Tomasoni, Senator Letts.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Ms. Ruiz, you've mentioned a bunch of studies without being specific in support of your testimony. Do you have information you can share with us in terms of the specific studies that have found
Absolutely.
It to be safe? And also, who funded those studies?
Mm-hmm. We have 6 volumes of reports and studies that were funded through the EU process and other independent credible scientific organizations such as National Academy of Science. And EPA, US EPA, and we can certainly get those to you in very much detail if you'd like.
Including information as to who funded the studies.
Like, mm-hmm. Absolutely.
The key that I heard there was independent.
Independent.
So
that
you
that's
didn't
correct.
Pay to get the answers that you wanted.
Right.
I think that's right. Senator Tomasoni.
I'll renew my motion to extend the date to 2012, Mr.
Okay, I think that's pretty clear. Further discussion on that amendment? All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Further discussion on the bill. Senator Scheid.
Then, Mr. Chairman, I'd move that Senate File 651 as amended be recommended to pass. Don't think it has to go anyplace else?
Mr. Chairman,
okay.
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to vote for it. I think... I would like to have a discussion with Senator Pappas before it passes off the floor as to whether or not we should put language in the bill that says dependent upon finding a suitable alternative to the DECA. And I don't want to have that discussion now, but maybe in the future.
Okay. Discussion? Further discussion? Senator Scheid, did you move the bill as amended?
Mr. Chairman, I did. I'm nodding. I'm sorry.
Okay. Yeah, yes, that didn't get it.